Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brook and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Hi, this is Alan Phillips, co-host with the weekly Vaccines and Your Rights radio show on Homeopathy World Community. Normally, Debbie Brook, founder of Homeopathy World Community, and I are together every Thursday. We're having a delay today into Friday instead of Thursday this week due to some scheduling conflicts. We are here this week with Greg Glazer. Greg, are you with us?
Hey, Alan, how you doing?
Doing fine. How are you doing today, Greg?
Doing well, thanks.
Pleasure, as always, to have you here with us today. Debbie's not here. I don't know what the story there is, but let's go on ahead here. You've got an exciting topic for us, as always. We're going to dig into some real interesting things here. Let's just dive on in. Give us kind of an overview or introduction about what you'd like to where you'd like to direct us today, Greg.
Sure, yeah. Today we're going to be talking about the distinction between local police power. This is the power of your local government to enforce local law, which includes public health measures. And then we're going to compare that to a federal authority, which is in the Constitution, called the Interstate Commerce Power, which allows the federal government to regulate commerce among the states.
Now, we've talked about the Jacobson case many times in the past with you and probably some on other shows as well. Can you give us just a real quick summary here, just so, again, for kind of background information, again, just in case anyone listening hasn't heard or doesn't remember that, what this 1905 Supreme Court case, the Jacobson case, tells us about the state police power as it has to do with vaccines?
Yeah, of course. Jacobson versus Massachusetts was a 1905 case that discussed the government's limited power to vaccinate. It involved a preacher who was refusing vaccination in Massachusetts, and he challenged this local law, which were required vaccination for all residents. Otherwise, they had to pay a fine. So this preacher challenged the law, saying that it violated his due process rights. And the case went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the court discussed what local power the governments traditionally have, and in the process of that, they ended up finding in favor of the local government of Massachusetts and saying that they were within their power to enact this mandatory vaccination law, but only in the sense that if you wanted to refuse vaccination, all you had to do was just leave the jurisdiction, because the only penalty was a fine. They couldn't put you in jail. That was in 1905, and there's never been a case that's affirmatively challenged Jacobson.
So we have sort of a backdrop, and again, I'm just looking for kind of the broad sweep for purposes here, because I don't want to get too sidetracked, because I think you've got a fascinating topic today, and I can't wait to hear more about this. But traditionally, the states, would this be correct, or feel free to clarify, that my understanding that traditionally the states have, under the Constitution, authority to use police power for perhaps a variety of mostly very reasonable and common sense needs, but under Jacobson, the police power extends to the subject of vaccines in the sense that the state can at least in some circumstances, mandate vaccines. I would say, and I don't want to get too far afield here, it's my understanding that Jacobson, because originally Jacobson was talking about just an emergency, a smallpox outbreak, which is something very different about can you be required outside of the context of an emergency to be mandated. I think those are two very fair and distinct and separate questions, but it's my impression that the courts have extended that emergency context to include, or certainly I think we could say vaccine policy has extended, if nothing else, maybe the courts as well, but extended that fairly limited application, I think, at least initially in Jacobson, to the emergency context, really to any sort of routine immunizations or immunization context. But
and a case in point of that would be the case of Duct, which went all the way to the Supreme Court in 1920, and the court did exactly that. They extended Jacobson to just matters where kids were going to public school, and they said, well, yeah, this ordinance does not confer arbitrary power, just the discretion required for the protection of the public health, which was one of the emphasizing points of the Jacobson case, that they were going to give great discretion to your local health board or your local government to decide whether there is an issue in your community with regard to public health. And if so, courts are going to be very deferential to those decisions made by your local government. And
now, I know in my work, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just agreeing that, you know, traditionally the public health power, the measures and regulations to protect public health have been within the power of the state and not the federal government. And then, so our topic today is going to look deeper into that and see whether that has changed. And now today you have two overlapping spheres. You have massive federal government control over public health, as we see with the FDA, for example, and the CDC. The CDC touches just about every aspect of national public health measures and works to coordinate local responses, especially for emergency purposes.
Now, we've talked in the past about where the boundaries are in terms of what the federal government can or can't do, and I have argued that there are certain arenas where the federal government, as a starting point, as sort of a legal technicality, doesn't have reach. For example, the CDC recommends vaccines, but it's really up to the individual states to decide whether or not to enact laws that the CDC recommends. But I think the practical reality is that the federal government exerts considerable influence, and you could almost say even where technically they don't control it in a direct way. The CDC doesn't itself directly require school children to be vaccinated to go to school, but the CDC makes recommendations that the states largely endorse. And so for practical purpose, I think we could say that the federal government does exert a tremendous amount of control there. Would you agree or have any clarification on that point?
Yeah. I'll clarify by adding a quote from legal scholar Wendy Mariner, who wrote that, quote, "Even in an emergency, when there is a rapidly spreading contagious disease and an effective vaccine, the state is not permitted to forcibly vaccinate or medicate anyone." So, close quote. And I think that is, you know, a very important point to recognize. And the Congressional Research Service has also acknowledged that the state is not allowed to forcibly vaccinate individuals, but rather the constitutional alternative, the protection of individual rights, requires striking a balance between the state's duty to protect public health and the individual's right to be free from forced medical treatment. A vaccine would be a forced medical treatment. And so they do is they come out and they say, well, okay, if you resist vaccines in an emergency and they are otherwise required, then we're going to put you into quarantine. And then once you're in quarantine, it's, you know, you're in prison. You know, it's like a healthcare prison. So, you know, which is absolutely a punishment. So in that sense, it's like forcing vaccination.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so what is then? What is interstate commerce? Because you mentioned a distinction between local police power and federal interstate commerce. What is federal interstate commerce? What does that refer to or cover?
Yeah, originally, at the time of the drafting of the Constitution, interstate commerce referred to the exchange of commodities and goods between states and also between nations as well, which is why Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution uses the term to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states. And then later on, that term was evolving as the federal government grew. But, you know, again, going back to the time of drafting of the Constitution, this was a big issue for debate as to whether this provision could grow and become its own animal. Alexander Hamilton was one of the at the forefront of the debate in particular, and it kind of went hand in hand. This whole Article 1, Section 8, there was at the very bottom of the section, there's another clause, and it really goes hand in hand with the Commerce Clause. It says it's called the Necessary and Proper Clause, and it gives Congress the authority, quote, to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof, close quote. So when we read those two provisions together, we think, okay, well, Congress has the power to regulate commerce and then to make any other laws which are necessary and proper for carrying into execution, you know, the regulation of commerce. And so this has given the federal government an incentive to make things very relevant to commerce, because if it's relevant to commerce, then they can regulate it. And traditionally, this provision was construed very narrowly because states' rights was very important back at the time of founding of the Constitution and then time of the Civil War. And only when you got to around the New Deal era did it start to be was there this major shift. And, you know, in law school we read about the President Roosevelt and his court packing plan and how to pass the New Deal legislation, Roosevelt threatened to pack the court with 16 judges rather than 9, and this shifted. And then all of a sudden the judges changed their tune. Oh, yeah, okay, well, we'll interpret the Necessary and Proper Clause and the Commerce Clause power to allow greater federal government control. And this was considered ending of the Lochner era, for those who are familiar. I could go a little bit more into Lochner, but I'll just kind of leave it there for now.
And when in history are we talking about now? When was the New Deal? Just so we have a time perspective here.
Yeah, you're looking at the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is when you had the shift. And again, Jacobson 1905, Zuchter was 1920, Lochner was I think 1907. And so these cases we're talking about. Actually, Lochner was decided the same year as Jacobson. Again, the history of America involved slavery and oppression of workers, and that was what was really going on behind the scenes. And so, you know, it's folly for us to say that states' rights is some great beacon of liberty. You know, a lot of times states' rights was just used as a proxy for the control of workers and promotion of slavery. And so that's important to keep in mind lest we get, you know, ahead of ourselves here or be overly righteous with regard to states' rights.
So it's an important point. You know, some have said that initially the nation was founded with ideals and ideas of religious liberty, and that to many people what that meant was you could be any kind of Christian that you wanted to.
Right,
and that
right.
It's only been since the founding of our nation that we have more broadly construed the idea of religious freedom to incorporate, you know, all religions and no religions. But anyway, the idea of commerce now, is this getting into the – are we tying this in now to the production and sale and distribution and use of vaccines? Is that where this comes into the conversation or
– Yeah. Let's jump right into that. So let's go a little bit more into the history, and then we'll lead into vaccines. So,
sure.
So interstate commerce, to most rational people, you think, okay, this is commodities between states. But then, along with the New Deal, you know, and they were trying to get more federal power, judges just tortured their logic. They said, all right, we need to find a way to make commerce include pretty much everything. So there was this, then this case comes along. It's called the Filburn case, and it's in 1940. And this is a time when the nation is leading up to war and economic turmoil and so forth. So Roscoe Filburn is this dairy farmer in Ohio, and he's a dairy farmer and a poultry farmer, and he's raising just a small quantity of wheat on his farm. It's like a homestead farm, and he uses some of it for himself and to feed his own livestock, and a little bit he sells. And so the federal government then passes this Agricultural Adjustment Act, which regulates the price of wheat and the planting of wheat. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to raise the price of wheat across the nation. And so and anyone who doesn't comply with their rules gets fined. And so this farmer is fined, but he refuses to pay. He says, this is insane. I'm a homestead farmer growing my own wheat. You can't tell me how much wheat I can plant. And he says, this is not interstate commerce. I'm growing this on my own farm. I'm using it myself. And amazingly, the Supreme Court justices unanimously favored the government. They said that this guy, Filburn, was growing wheat for his own use, and even though he would not be buying any, this affected interstate commerce because if the price of wheat rose, then Filburn might be tempted to sell his surplus wheat in the interstate market, which would thwart the government's objective. It said that, quote, supplies the need of the man who grew it, which would otherwise be reflected by purchases in the open market. Homegrown wheat, in this sense, competes with wheat in commerce. And as legal scholar Epstein commented, could anyone say with a straight face that the consumption of homegrown wheat is commerce among the several states? Close quote. And the answer is no. I mean, it was such a tortured extension of logic. It was just like they decided that they were going to have federal power, and so they just made a decision which would authorize this.
And this raises if I could interject real briefly here, just sort of a side point, but I think it's an important one. I guess I've been in many ways in my life a bit naive, and part of that comes from being an idealist. And I like to think that the purpose of the courts, for example, is to interpret the law in a neutral and fair manner, and that the purpose of legislators, state level or national level, is to take an objective look at what the state's needs are and to enact laws accordingly. And yet we all know to one degree or another the practical reality is that something else often dictates what happens in the legislatures or in the courts, and that's what we might loosely refer to as politics. This sounds, when what you describe, like a situation where clearly there was the, in effect, if not literally, a predetermined outcome in order to exercise what sounds on its face anyway to be an extreme, if not absurd, overreach of authority. Is that your read on this, that this was a pure politics about control and so forth, and not really about reasonable law?
Yeah. It had been coming for a long time, back from Roosevelt's court packing suggestion in the 30s, you know, and then here we are in the 40s, and now it's official. And so after this case, after this Filburn case, everything just kind of became mere detail, you know, and anything was commerce. You know, you could regulate, and the same rationale started to apply in other things. Like I saw one case of where they were regulating rice paddies as navigable waters of the United States, because theoretically you could get a boat on a rice paddy. it's silly, you know. And I don't know, does silliness have a place in the law? Apparently so. And entire bodies of law sprang from this, from these authorities, using even the commerce power. The government was regulating the bigotry of restaurant owners. And then in 1995. A case came along that, for the first time, according to scholars, challenged the Commerce Clause authority. And this case was called United States versus Lopez, and the government passed a law regulating handguns near schools, that you couldn't have a handgun within 1,000 feet of a school. And the government said that the reason this related to commerce was that the possession of a firearm in an educational environment would most likely lead to violent crime, which in turn would affect the general economic condition in two ways. That violent crime causes harm and creates expense, which raises insurance costs, which spreads throughout the economy. And second, it limits the willingness of people to travel in an area perceived to be unsafe. So, as you can see, this is just kind of, you know, a great stretch. But this is where, you know, the logic of lawyers had gone. It was just like, all right,
and,
well,
and
what
how
do we
that
need
case
to do
out?
To make you nod your head, you know?
And what was the holding in Lopez there? I mean, what was the ruling there? Because that seems like, you know, again, on a common sense level, that seems like one heck of a stretch in terms of some place where the federal government could or should have any sort of direct control.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, and I think it had gotten so far-fetched that even the Supreme Court had to rein it in. They said, all right, this is just building assumption on assumption. So in a 5-4 decision, it was Justice Rehnquist, he found in favor, they negated the law. They overruled. They said it was unconstitutional, that it was this wasn't within the interstate commerce power, and that there has to be a substantial relation to interstate commerce. It has to affect the channels of interstate commerce or substantially affect interstate commerce in some way. And so they laid out this new test, but you know, it really didn't stop any. And, you know, it's still so broad. You know, Rehnquist delivered this opinion, but he didn't overrule any other cases. You know, so, you know, and as we've seen since 1995, does it look like the federal government is gaining power or losing power? They're gaining power. They're obviously gaining power.
Well, you know? They're not just gaining, they're grabbing. I mean, it's gotten so brazen.
Really, and so Lopez was the sort of seminal decision, and everybody thought, oh, this is going to be a big case in determining the Obamacare, you know, and so that is probably a good segue for us to talk about medicine and vaccinations.
Yeah, so we have this very broad federal government power under the Commerce Clause dealing with interstate commerce authority, and then we have this local police power of the states in being able to enact and enforce vaccine mandates. What's the intersection of these two different arenas?
Yeah, so essentially the way that judges have so Obamacare was passed in 2010, and since then it's come under constitutional attack at the federal level, and it's gone all the way up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court's going to hear arguments on it next month. And the judges, some have ruled that it's constitutional, and others have ruled that it's unconstitutional. And so one of the judges who ruled that it's unconstitutional in January of last year, Judge Vinson, it was really how he phrased the question. He phrased the question as whether Congress can regulate inactivity. Can they make you buy something? Can they make you buy a private company's product? And when you phrase the question like that, then it sounds like, well, the answer should be no. You know, we live in a republic of individual rights. You know, Congress can't pass a law that requires everyone to go buy a McDonald's hamburger. They can't require everyone to go buy a bushel of broccoli from any particular company. And so this has been called, people are referring to it as the broccoli argument, whether, you know, the federal government can make you buy a product. And Andrew Napolitano had an argument about this, which I found pertinent. He said that the practice of medicine consists of the delivery of intimate services to the human body. So in almost all instances, the delivery of medical services occurs in one place and does not move across interstate lines. One goes to a physician not to engage in commercial activity, as the framers of the Constitution understood, but to improve one's health. And the practice of medicine, much like public school safety, has been regulated by states for the past century. So what Napolitano is trying to do is he's trying to make it like a states' rights argument.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's what the government has always done is they said, well, we're not going to look at the individual. You know, we're not concerned with the individual. We're concerned about how the activities of all people as a nation affect commerce. Well, if you look at what everybody does, then it's always going to affect commerce in some way. And so it's so important how one phrases the question. I find it to be highly immoral to require a person to purchase a product from a corporation or anybody. It's just it's not fun. Oh, I mean, to me, that's like quintessential fascism. In a republic, the government is supposed to respect the individual. And sure, there's a balance with the police power. They're not supposed to mandate communal economic transactions. You know, that's just, oh yeah. And in that balance, I'm hoping that logic will prevail. But that's another thing, is that it's like logic is not meant to prevail. The more that people understand the Constitution and the limits that the Constitution puts on the federal government, the less power that the federal government has. So the federal government has an incentive to people not understand the Constitution, or to make it illogical, or to muddy it, to create complex legal analysis.
Go ahead and finish your thought, and I'll jump in.
Yeah, I was just saying that it's ironic. It's self fulfilling. You know that old maxim, ignorantia juris non excusat. It's ignorance of the law is no excuse. Well, it becomes self fulfilling. You know, the less people understand of the Constitution, the more power that they have, the more the law trumps. Yeah.
Yes, and it's interesting here, because this goes back to the point I raised earlier, and this is, for me, it's kind of this ongoing question, not only through our show today, but through our life as we navigate these matters in our day-to-day life, that the reality of politics versus the more theoretical or technical legal arguments or preferences, you know, when to me, on just sort of a common sense level, the idea that any government, state or federal, but especially the federal, is going to tell me I have to buy insurance or have to get a vaccine or anything else, it just seems so fundamentally opposed to the basic concepts of individual liberty, where I think the government has gotten mileage with the vaccine issue is by argument that my vaccination status affects other people, and therefore the government has a right to impose on me what my vaccination status will be, because it's not just a question of I want a red card, not a blue one, or something more inherently self-limiting in that sense. We could get off, I don't want to go too far on a tangent, all of that then, as it pertains to vaccines, rests on the idea of the herd immunity theory, which has been, as far as I'm concerned, repeatedly disproven over and over again many times. It's just not really a reliable theory, and so the whole idea of that as a basis why government can impose vaccines where government doesn't impose other things, to me that whole argument falls apart. But when you get into the idea of insurance, and what I know in my own independent research as a layperson on vaccines is that there are other alternatives. And so the idea of government requiring anything raises the question of the government looking from among choices, or even not looking from among choices, but basically removing a choice. And when there are choices, or even deciding whether or not there's a choice for me. It's the idea of choice and freedom. Of course, when you add politics into that, then the mix gets even just muddier or more complicated or more confusing, because then you have misinformation or disinformation or, various things that go along with politics, ultimately conflicts of interest, and if you, anybody who really looks deeply into the vaccine issue will see there are serious corruption issues and so forth. And so I come away from all of this, Greg, with the realization that politics is the reality, even if theoretically or idealistically it should be minimally or non-existent in its presence, but yet the practical reality is it's there. So the ongoing question is, what is it? How does it work? How do we deal with it? Because I feel at times that people in a pro-choice vaccine side of the vaccination issue are at a disadvantage. You know, I feel like we have to go in and make the legal arguments and the medical arguments and practical arguments the best we can, and yet we're going up against not only against a well-funded pharmaceutical industry and healthcare industry that is serving its own agenda, but one that gets to use these other kinds of techniques, if you will, to use propaganda, to use politics, to use misinformation or disinformation. It's anything but just a matter of bringing all the different opinions and facts to the table so we can sort them out and see what's really supposed to happen. So, and what you're describing suggests this has been going on in the courts with regard to interstate commerce. Where does this leave us then? How, you know, with what's the federal interstate authority then as all this pertains to vaccines?
Hmm.
And forgive me for sort of rambling on a little too long there. I think I lost my initial point.
No, it's fine. When it comes to the human body, there have been rulings that relate to whether the body is put into commerce, so like an organ trade or stem cell research. Stem cell research, that was actually, you had an article on that, Alan, on the Pandemic Response Project website from last month, and it related to what the FDA was saying, that on their website they say, quote, stem cells, like other medicinal products that are intended to treat, cure, or prevent disease, generally require FDA approval before they can be marketed. At this time, there are no licensed stem cell treatments, close quote. And so, you know, what the FDA is doing is they're going out and trying to claim that, you know, your body or that aspect of your body is a drug which can be regulated. And, you know, personally, I think tinkering with stem cells is a very dangerous activity, and it's just another example of man going outside of his province and thinking he's so great. But the point in a legal sense is whether the government gets to commoditize the body. And it makes us, you know, it gives us an opportunity to look at, well, what is commerce? In one case, I think it was the Rate case, they defined it as, it was the commoditization. I want to get the exact quote for you because it's really helpful.
While you're looking there, oh, you got it?
In the Ray case, it says, economics refers to the production, distribution, and consumption of commodities. And this was a case where they were trying to regulate marijuana in regards to the California medicinal marijuana law, and they found in favor of the federal government. And Justice Scalia, writing for the court, was discussing interstate commerce and trying to figure out where the boundary is. And, you know, he took the traditional government line, which is that the regulation of an intrastate, meaning one state activity, may be essential to a comprehensive regulation of interstate commerce, even though the intrastate activity is not itself substantially affected. Interstate commerce. It's hard on the radio to get that. It's easier when you see it in writing, inter and intra. But the point that he's making is that even non-economic local activity can still be regulated if it's a part of a more general regulation of interstate commerce. So, and that, you know, again, is with regard to the human body. So to the extent that government is contextualizing the debate in terms of commerce, then the federal government will be able to expand its power. And to the extent that the debate is referred to in terms of individual rights, it's going to be in favor of the individual. And both before and after the time of the Constitution's drafting, societies have respected commerce so highly that societies have built government power around attempts to interfere with it. You know, even Gandhi said that poverty is the worst form of violence. And when we look historically at societies that do, that have failed commercial structures, you know, you find rampant poverty. And I think the constitutional founders recognized this when they granted to Congress the power to regulate interstate commerce, in the sense that they didn't want states trying to create monopolies or create like tariffs among states. They wanted a free flow of commerce. And so I think what we're dealing with here is something that goes very deep on a philosophical level. And then on a practical level, what should I start with, practical or philosophical? Well, let me just throw out something which you probably did not know. And I didn't know either until I read this commentary by a legal scholar named Einar Elhaus. And he was saying that many people argue that the Constitution's framers could not possibly have envisioned a congressional power to force purchases. However, in 1790, the first Congress, which was packed with framers, required all ship owners to provide medical insurance for seamen. And then in 1978, Congress also required seamen to buy hospital insurance for themselves. And in 1792, Congress enacted a law mandating that all able-bodied citizens obtain a firearm. So that's three laws at the time of the framing of the Constitution that Congress required purchases. So that to me, I found very, very surprising. Had the heavy emphasis on commerce, which I think is a good lead into the philosophical debate that's going on here, because commerce and money are really just they're not the source of power. They're just an effect. You know, money and commerce show the effects or the shadow of energy, and energy can be used to create or destroy. You know, so the source of commerce, power, and energy, I think, comes from the character of the commerce. And ideally, the character of the commerce is virtue. So commerce by itself should not be sufficient to vest power in government, but rather the quality of that commerce. And that's why the quality of individual rights is so important in a republic, as we balance the effects of individual rights versus the effects of commerce or war or, you know, fill in the blank here with regard to government power. And by focusing solely on commerce, we put the effect, the shadow, before the source. That's the philosophical problem that we're dealing with. And that's why I shudder when I read some of these Supreme Court opinions, which talk about commerce as if it were this high and mighty thing, and interstate commerce as being, and everything affecting interstate commerce. It's not logical. It's pandering to the economic institutions that are behind the scenes of power today. And, I'm sorry, you were going to say something?
No, go ahead, you're on a roll here.
Yeah, I find, you know, and I read these law review articles, and they could be so upsetting. Like, well, there's this one, a Harvard Law Review article, quote, "Public safety and security may be best characterized as public goods." What is that?
Wow.
I don't understand that. Quote, "One's consumption of public security does not reduce the general level of security available in a community." Close quote. It's this idea that they're trying to analyze public safety and security as commercial commodities. You know, it's like I'm just going to give a silly example to show the absurdity here. It's like if the if Article 1, Section 8, if instead of saying interstate commerce, they said international sale of pancakes. Just imagine how important pancakes would be today. You know, the government would go to great lengths to find things very related to pancakes. Who knows? You might even have a pancake currency. And obviously, I'm creating this very silly example to show how things get skewed when you frame the debate in one sense. And but bringing it back to reality here, getting away from my silly example, as Richard Epstein, the legal commentator, has written, the barrier between production and commerce was not as well defined as the courts have held. And so we've always seen this ebb and flow in the interpretations of interstate commerce. And it came to a head in 1995, again, with the Lopez case. And now that we're seeing the effects of Obamacare and where that is going to be, where it's going to go in the future. The fines get issued in 2015, so it may be rendered moot until then. But I think, you know, it's just a big testing ground for what people want to do. And, you know, again, it seems that this whole Commerce Clause issue hinges on the American people not caring about the logic of it, not caring about what the actual text of the Constitution says. And
or the implications
of
the way it's being.
They know that I'm not the big proponent of the Constitution as this sacred document. I would like to amend it and have a great if you want to learn more, go to my website, Civil Action Network, and you can learn about my proposals for a remedy. But the point that I wanted to make here is that so it's the ignorance of the populace that justifies this greater governmental power. And the Commerce Clause has been able to grow over time through that ignorance. And it reminds me of the admonition in the Bible to beware the leaven of the Pharisees, and or in Hosea, you know, cut off have my people been for lack of knowledge. The next way I think would be to talk about where the Commerce Clause has been beneficial. The Commerce Clause has proved very useful in justifying environmental regulations, especially over depletable natural resources, because the Constitution does not provide explicit authority for the federal government to intervene in natural resource affairs. There's some limited exceptions, but it's been through the commerce power, through the interstate commerce power, that the federal government has enacted so many environmental regulations, which Americans have benefited from. You know, we've enjoyed these benefits, but then when it comes to extending the Commerce Clause to other natural capital resources, we're very wary of the slippery slope. And I've been talking about the slippery slope a lot in this show, but yet I favor environmental regulations based on the Commerce Clause, or a lot of them. But
to me it seems – let me jump in real quick here, because to me it seems that there's a real kind of obvious – connection of environmental issues to a national scene, that environmental issues that happen within a state many, many times will affect neighboring states, if not beyond. And so I can I can really make that connection on a common sense level, whereas when you were, for example, talking earlier about California growing, you know, having laws pertaining to the growing of marijuana inside the state of California, what business is that of the federal government? To me, on a common sense level, I don't see that connection there, and you have to get sort of you have to go through I would imagine, I mean, I haven't studied the case, but I would imagine you have to go through some exercises in logic to come out at a in effect predetermined result in order to do that. And so it concerns me. But let me, if I may, just one other quick point before I lose sight of it here, because it is certainly all well and good as far as it goes to look at the phrase, to figure out what reasonable interpretations there are, to apply that hopefully in reasonable and productive ways, which clearly today's conversation is about the fact that that's not always what happens. Even though sometimes it is, but it seems to me there's this kind of underlying concern that I, as a person who's a strong advocate for personal liberty, especially as it pertains to vaccines as a particular area of focus, to me I recognize that the greater authority that the federal government has, or to put it in a perhaps more generic sort of way, the more centralized that power is in any arena, there's greater ability to do perhaps both good and harm, depending on how that power is used or misused. But the main point is that where there is greater power, there is it's going to be, or even the greater the power, the more centralized power is, the more influence any one political position, for example, or other non-position has, the more that's going to be attractive to people who want to use that for improper reasons, or the more that people who have a personal agenda that can benefit from influencing a position of power, the more they will try to influence it or want to influence it. And so on a matter of sort of general principle in terms of potential for harm and the practical reality of people with personal agendas or companies or corporations with agendas that they can benefit from by influencing power that's not intended to be used that way, the more we're going to see human beings being what we are, that sort of thing happen. And as we see, as we've discussed many times over and over again in different ways, if you explore the vaccine issue, you see, in fact, that that's what's going on with vaccines, and indeed, I'm sure it's going on anywhere and everywhere else that it can as well. And it seems to me there's this underlying argument separate and apart from the more analytical, what are the proper definitions or interpretations and how should those be applied, or can they be applied, and when can they be applied in productive and constructive ways that, you know, most people would support and agree with. There's this sort of underlying general concept or principle of concerning abuse of power, which to me argues against the centralization of power and authority, and therefore, as a general principle, against the growing of the federal government and in favor of shrinking the federal government, not just for the cost reasons that people say, oh, you know, the bigger the federal government is, the more taxpayers have to fund this larger government and so forth. Those are certainly valid issues and concerns. But for me, the even greater issue is the resulting misuse and abuse of power. Do you feel like, you know, sort of the political reality that happens, do you feel like that is something that doesn't get the kind of attention that it should in do people get bogged down into the analysis of it and really get away from the sometimes, I think, far greater concern, which is the political reality, the power and control issues that are really behind or underneath a lot of different issues? Do you think that do you see that goes on in the vaccine issue, and how? Where does the Commerce Clause, you know, come into this in terms of vaccines and federal authority?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, the way that the Commerce Clause is defined today, it's so expansive that if an activity is tangentially connected to interstate commerce, then Congress may regulate it, whether or not the actual person engaging in that activity is engaged in commerce or not. So by the federal government's commercialization of medicine and the human body, you know, pharmaceutical medication, health insurance, et cetera, this causes collateral damage to the few natural organic Americans who want nothing to do with commercialized medicine, especially pharmaceuticals. Because what we're doing is we're saying the republic doesn't matter. What matters is, you know, your individual rights are secondary to the aggregate national commercial effect, which Congress may regulate. So whether or not your particular activity has any bearing on interstate commerce doesn't matter. It's whether your community's activities have a bearing on interstate commerce, whether the nation's. Well, in that case, they all do. And so where is the limit? And only that Lopez case stood out as being related to that limit. But again,
does this expanding federal power then, and this kind of and crazy definitions of interstate commerce, allowing the federal government to then exert greater control and influence over individuals and communities, where does this move us with regard to the starting place or the presumed starting place as a democratic republic? Are we getting, because we've had many conversations in the past where we've talked about, are we really still a republic or not? And it seems to me that this would be something that would move us away from where we started and what we were intended to be as in terms of the Founding Fathers. Any thoughts or comments on that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, if the government can force you to buy a product from a company, that is not a republic. That is called fascism. You can look it up in a thesaurus, in a dictionary, not a thesaurus. If the federal government has the power to protect the natural environment, then that relates to a specific and individualized logical place of power because it is relates to protecting like an actual source and value. But when we have regulation of interstate commerce, the original intent of that, according to the framers, was to prevent tariffs and monopolies and so forth. And then for it to expand, it would be okay if it did expand if it was just logical. But I think what we have is a situation of expanding power just for its own consolidated sense. And I suppose it wouldn't be that bad if we had a benevolent government that was acting in the best interests of the American people and not starting wars and spreading chemtrails and so forth. You know, it's not, which again is why I wanted to bring up that point early on in the show that states' rights is not the answer here, and that it's very easy to have this debate turn into a false debate or a red herring, you know, to discuss whether it's federal power or state power, which is better. The answer is it doesn't really matter. It's just who's the more benevolent government, who's going, you know, what, even if it were a kingdom, it'd be better to have a kingdom than with which protects individual rights and has an organic natural community and less violence and so forth. And what I see today is just the collection of words to create what is a tolerable standard of living and pollution, a tolerable standard of, I'm tripping over my words here. We're getting late in the show. tolerable standard of living and pollution and crime. It's that if you'll tolerate it, then they're going to do it. And what they're trying to do is create this society that just perpetuates this economic this economic empire that also accomplishes these things for whatever your interests are. If you're interested in building giant telescopes or bombs or hospitals, then you know you're going to find a government that has both regulations and incentives for you to accomplish these objectives. And they ebb and flow. But in the aggregate, what we find is that it's the money that has been driving these forces, and through the consolidation of power and through certain key moves throughout history, including Supreme Court cases, they have justified this power, and it has not been reined in. And states' rights, which was poised theoretically to rein it in, lost its moral legitimacy because, again, it was states' rights was rooted in this rich, in this terribly rich history of slavery and the oppression of workers. And so, you know, it never had the moral authority to begin with. So why would we expect it really to combat the illogic of federal government expansion? So the remedy has to be looking somewhere outside of this. And I think the remedy is to go toward a logical interpretation of the Constitution and a return to the stable values which provide meaning to commerce. Again, it's the character of the commerce, which is ideally the virtue of the commerce, that provides the power and energy. Commerce and money are just a shadow. They are an effect of power. And that power can be used for to destroy, or it can be used to generate, to create something. And where mankind is going is that we are building institutions of destruction in all the major industries. The process of making even simple commodities today, like steel, it could be incredibly coal power, just incredibly destructive to the environment. The healthcare industry, incredibly destructive to human health and also the environment. The war industry, quite obviously, is destructive to our social institutions and the fabric of education and child rearing and commerce as well. The institution of education so much is about the dumbing down of the populace to train them rather than educate them to be free thinkers. And this has been going on so long that it becomes difficult to separate the propaganda from the reality, which is why I'm brought back to that famous maxim, ignorantia juris non excusat.
So are we, is legislative activism here then? Do you think that's a key point here in our last about a minute left here, I think we have or so of the show, is that I mean, there's I don't think there's any simple answer to all of this, but is legislative activism? Do you feel like that's a key part of what we as individual citizens need to get involved in
to
deal with some of these issues?
So, I think that we need to remember first, though, that legislation is just words, and words derive their meaning from logic. And so without the law, you have to put the logic first. And until the populace starts waking up to what's really going on here, again, with regard to war and chemtrails and so forth, we're not going to have the legislation to solve it. And I'll just I'm gonna quote ominously from the New York Times, October 28, 1973, a quote from Henry Kissinger, quote, "The illegal we do immediately. The unconstitutional takes a little longer," close quote.
Boy, that's...
Enact all the legislation...
Let's hear that. That was quick. Let's hear that one more time, please.
Okay, yeah. Kissinger's quote is, "The illegal we do immediately. The unconstitutional takes a little longer."
Boy, it's an interesting takeoff.
From Rothschild, which is that the... well, there's Madame Rothschild. "If my sons did not want wars, there would be no wars." And then there's the "Give me control of a nation's money supply, and I care not who makes its laws." So again, the logic has to come. The logic and the virtue have to come before the law. The law is just words put on paper. And look at what our attorneys have done to interstate commerce. We have turned rice paddies into navigable waters. You know.
So we have to.
We've turned a homestead farmer growing wheat into interstate commerce, okay? What kind of law are you going to enact that's going to prevent the further expansion of the American empire and its interrelatedness in the international spheres of military-industrial complexes? You know, it's not going to be simple. It's going to be logic and virtue, and I think that's where we find that it's not going to be solved in a generation. It's an individual struggle, which...
Not without a mass awakening anyway, right? I mean, we need to wake up and we need to grow up, to put it in really kind of simplistic terms, it seems to me. But short of some sort of mass awakening, it would really could take generations.
Yeah. I mean, and the point that I'm making is that the mass awakening is not happening. And this information has been out there for a very long... I mean, you can go back a century and find books written about the consolidation of power, the New World Order, the bankers, and so forth. And so the information has been out there. And if it hasn't been acted upon for a century, then the mass awakening is not happening. And the struggle has been about the individual. And this, I think, is justice. It's fair because it's fair for society to reap what it sows, to suffer the slings and arrows of its outrageous fortune. Isn't that just? You know, if you sow genetically modified seeds, what do you expect to get? Natural, organic fruit? The world does not work that way. Do we really want to live in a world that doesn't have cause and effect? I think that the mass awakening of people coming to this logic and setting things right is not meant to happen in this generation. We're meant to suffer the effects of our illogical righteousness.
Well, we certainly are in the suffering stage of that, but I certainly hope you're wrong. I don't have any hard evidence to refute, but I certainly hope you're wrong about the mass awakening. I'll proudly claim my naivete on this next comment. I'm cautiously optimistic that the mass awakening is possible, but we'll see. You know, we'll see as things play out. These are very interesting times. There's no question about that. And I think this year in particular is going to be particularly fascinating. But we need. Let's go ahead and wrap up. Greg, do you want to have finish with any sort of closing comment or summary here, and then we'll go ahead and wrap up the show for this week. We really want to thank everybody for listening. We'll be back next week at a regularly scheduled Thursday time, Thursday noon Eastern time, for Vaccines and Your Rights. And Greg is with us once a month always glad to have you. Greg, I always learn something fascinating and new, if not many, many things from you every time you're on. So always really glad to have you here and really look forward to having you back. Any closing comments for today?
Yeah, sure. This is a comment to remind that as men, we should not ignore the reality that commerce is not the source of power. It's an effect. It's a shadow. And that the source of power ideally is going to come from the character of the commerce, the virtue of it. That's what we strive for.
Noble words. An important distinction. Greg, thanks so much for being with us again. Folks, come back with us again next Thursday. And Greg, we'll see you, probably the first or second Thursday of the month. We'll give notice of that in advance on what exact date that'll be. Thank you all for listening.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Let your truth be unfurled, one by one.